Hello and welcome to Series 5, Episode 7 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Oh, I've got a great episode for you today. It's a dear friend of mine, Zoe Lyons. Before we get into that, I want to say thank you to all of you that got in touch with me last week about self-esteem's episode. It seems loads of you enjoyed it. I got some gorgeous comments and some people left some lovely reviews on the iTunes app, which is really helpful, and giving it ratings. I know you hear this on every podcast, but it really helps people find it. Loads of messages as well and emails. So thank you so much for that. I love self-esteem. I think I made that very clear throughout the podcast. Her album, Prioritize Pleasure, is currently still in my most played Spotify list. I love it. And if you haven't listened to it yet, I highly, highly recommend it. The episode I've got coming up for you today is with my friend Zoe Lyons, who is a fantastic stand-up comedian. I absolutely love her. I've always been enormously inspired by her. And I think we have a really interesting conversation about, of course, comedy and about that world that we both live in, but also about anxiety, alopecia, and getting through the pandemic that we've all just been through and getting to the other side of it. I loved this conversation. I love Zoe, and I really think that you would too. Also, if you haven't seen her stand-up, I can't recommend her highly enough. She is brilliant. As always, I'm going to share some emails. I would love to be receiving some more. We always get some every single episode, but it'd be lovely to receive some more. So if you've been thinking about sharing your story or getting in touch or just letting me know what you think or what you'd like on the podcast, I've had some recommendations for different parts of the LGBTQIA plus community, and I'm doing my best in getting those people to talk to me. Trust that. But if you want to get in touch, you always can. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. Okay. Let's share some listener emails before we get into the conversation with Zoe. Dear Susie, I love the podcast. I listen every week and I always find something to relate to, no matter how different the people's journeys are. I think I'm a similar age to you and in a similar part of my life, recently married with a little one. My life is 100 miles an hour, but once a week I take myself on a walk with the podcast and the dog and I allow myself to breathe for a moment. Thank you for that. Like you, as a teen, I never thought I would have the love like I have now, or such a happy life. I wish I could have known. Hopefully for the younger ones in our community, shows like this and the amount of great queer representation on our screens, happy futures feel more possible. In brackets, although I would love to see more gay women. My 15-year-old self would have really appreciated this podcast, but I want you to know my 35-year-old self gets so much from it too. Thank you for all that you do. My wife and I loved your stand-up special. And that's with love from Annie. Thank you so much for getting in touch, Annie. I think you're absolutely right. There is a lot more representation of queer people on our screens, but I would love to see more gay women too. It does seem that if there is gay female representation, lesbian representation, it does seem that we always have to be in period costume. It would be lovely if there was just people like me or like you, I'm guessing, just in more shows, on more things. But hopefully a time is coming where there's going to be more and more of that. Thank you for saying that you loved my stand-up special. It gives me a lovely opportunity to plug it, Annie, so I really appreciate that. If you haven't watched it, my stand-up special is on Amazon Prime, and it's the first episode in the Soho Theatre Presents series, and maybe you'd enjoy it. I'm very, very proud of it. And yeah, if as many people as possible watch it, I'd be absolutely thrilled. Okay, one more email. Hi Susie, I just listened to today's podcast with self-esteem and I wanted to let you know how much I enjoyed it. I want to thank you for your podcast, as at the grand old age of 31, I have recently, finally, I've been dating girls since I was 19, very quietly, come out as bisexual to my close friends, and the stories on here have really helped me feel less ridiculous about being in the closet for so long and helped me reflect on things about my own life and history. Thanks again. I'm really hoping you continue to do the podcast because it's been absolutely lovely to listen to such a range of stories and recognise a lot of the experiences. And that's from Kate, brackets. I don't actually mind you using my name, which is a bit of a change from a year ago. Kate, thanks so much for getting in touch. I'm so pleased that the podcast has done that for you and been there for you. I think Jess Foster Q's episode is one that people quote to me a lot of times when I meet them after shows, or saying that they had their journey happened a little bit later for them, or their sexuality came to them a little bit later. And yeah, whenever it happens, it's totally cool, isn't it? It's like whenever you come to the club, the door's always open. And allies are allowed in the club as well, obviously. But thank you for getting in touch. And I will continue to do the podcast. I'm doing my best to do another series later in the year. We've pretty much got this series sewn up. We've got a very exciting, very special episode coming at the end of the series, which I'm very excited to share. But thank you for your kind words. Right, let's get into today's conversation. It's with the fantastic Zoe Lyons. I love her and I think you will too.
Oh, I'm very excited for today's guest. Zoe Lyons is an outstanding comedian. She's also my friend. You might have seen her on Mock the Week, Live at the Apollo, QI, or hosting her own BBC Two quiz show, Lightning, which has just returned for its second series. I've known Zoe since I started comedy about 13 years ago. And although I've never said this to her, I've always really looked up to her and been inspired by her. Great jokes, brilliant storytelling, unbelievably quick on her feet, and unapologetically herself. It's always a joy to work with her, and she really makes you up your game. Widely considered as one of the absolute best by her peers and the comedy industry, welcome to the show, Zoe.
Oh, I hardly recognise myself this.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I love a buttering up. That was lovely.
Oh, you're welcome. Do you know what? I was trying to think this morning. I was thinking, when was the first time I saw Zoe? And I think it would have been in around 2010 mm-hmm. at the Banana Cabaret.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yes. Okay. So I wasn't on and I came down. I lived really near the Banana Cabaret, and Dave, who runs it, used to let me come down and watch.
Yeah.
Because I was doing like open spots all over the shop and really shit open mic nights. And so I'd come and watch proper comedy. And I remember you had a bit about lesbians being washed up to the seaside. That's the only bit I remember. I think you must have just moved down to Brighton or something.
Yeah, I'm still doing that bit of material.
But I really distinctly remember thinking, oh, look, someone like me who's absolutely ripping it in front of all of these straight people, and they don't care about her sexuality. They just care that she's funny. And I remember being, it was quite sort of a seminal moment for me, because I was like, oh, it's possible.
Oh, but
I don't think, I don't think I'd seen anyone like you or like us.
Yeah.
I'd heard about you, and I think I came over to you afterwards and was like, hello, I've just started comedy. I'm Susie.
I do. I remember our chat. We stood like near the sound desk area upstairs on the balcony.
Yes,
and we had a little chat, and you had that enthusiasm of somebody just starting out in comedy. It was like, you know, as people get so excited because they realise it is a thing that they can possibly do, and it's that that whole sort of, you know, the show curtains open and there's a glimpse of what might be. And I recognise that excitement in you at the time. Yeah, yeah.
And then we've gigged quite a lot with each other over these. Although lesbians aren't allowed to be on a gig that frequently together.
Not unless we pre-plan it.
Not unless we pre-plan it and it's a charity.
It comes as a package deal. A bog off of lesbians. Yeah, buy one, get one free. We're largely interchangeable at gigs as well. If somebody's deliberately booked a gay woman and something happens and they have to pull out, they're like, I need another gay woman. Where am I going to get one? So it's like, oh, look in the gay drawer.
No, they find me, you, or Jen.
Yeah.
Although there are lots of other newer, younger gay women now doing stand-up. But for a while, it really seemed like you and Brista were... Obviously, there was like Rona Cameron and people like that before.
Yeah.
I don't know. When you first started stand-up, did it feel like it was an environment to be yourself in?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it was an environment I could see the potential where I could be myself in it. But initially, I found it very hard to do that. Mm. I started stand-up 20 years ago. I was reasonably late to the game. I'm going to say reasonably late to the game. I was 30, 29, 30. And even 20 years ago, simply being a woman on stage at times was a little bit challenging for some audience members.
I remember that as much as 10 years ago when you'd walk out and people would be like,
oh God, here we go. And people would automatically assume I was gay anyway, because if you're a woman on stage, 20 years ago, you clearly had some emotional issues. You were quite angry about stuff and therefore you were automatically a lesbian. So I didn't even really have to come out because people just assumed you were, but for all the wrong reasons, if you know what I mean. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I've had this said to me before. When I started, if you were a confident, strong woman on stage, you were angry and there was something wrong with you and you were clearly, you know, a sort of sexual deviant. If you're a confident, strong man on stage, those tags were never applied to you.
Mm.
There was a sort of resistance in certain parts of the audience to a confident, strong woman on stage. Yeah. Whereas now, thank God, we're like, yes, yes. It's not a threat. It's just something to embrace and enjoy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of male audience members sort of saw gay female stand-ups as some sort of a threat. When, of course, we're not. We're the least bit of a threat to them. So, yes, I saw the potential in stand-up as an arena where I could potentially be myself. But I'll be very honest, there were years when I felt very uncomfortable and I had to sort of steel myself, and I wasn't in my comfort zone at all. I was sort of pretending to be. I was styling it out. And you'll know this as much as anybody, that, you know, people love to say to women in comedy, or at least they did, you know, so hard, isn't it, for a lady? It's tricky, isn't it? And I never entertained that. I never indulged that thought. I just ploughed on through. And actually, there were times when it was bloody hard.
Yeah, it would be, it's hard, isn't it, being a woman in comedy? And you sort of go, well, I don't know what it's like being a man in comedy. I assume it's easier.
Yeah.
But it's easier to be a man in most arenas.
Yeah.
And then you get the other one, which is, I don't usually like female comedians, but I like you.
Often from women.
Always from women, it seemed.
It's like, wow, okay. So we're up against all of that sort of stuff, those sort of mindsets, which, yeah, you have to sort of battle that. Yeah. I'm always surprised when people say that. I don't often find women funny. I'm like, what about your mother or your sister or your niece or your auntie?
Yeah.
What, none of them? What, you just all sit round, poker-faced, knitting? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, traditionally, you know, excuse the language, but gaggles of girls have an absolute laugh together. That's what you do. We, you know, I've had jobs where it's been predominantly women, and that you sit around, you laugh, and you know, rip the piss out of each other. That's what we do. That's what being funny is about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I always think when women say, I don't usually like female comedians, don't usually find women funny, I think you need new friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't worry about coming to a comedy night. You need to find some friends that are a laugh.
Yeah, it really shines a light on their own social situation.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, you must be dull as dishwater. I feel sorry for you.
Don't worry. Do you know what? It doesn't actually bother me that I'm not making you laugh. Don't worry about it. I probably don't want you at my show. You're not a big laugher. Often we do this show sort of chronologically in a way. I know that you were you born in Wales?
Yeah, dropped there, but I was packed up pretty quickly and sent off to Ireland. Yeah, I never had time to develop the Welsh accent. Oh, so I've just slightly done that in the Welsh accent.
Until this moment right now.
Ooh, there it is. We left Wales when I was about 6 months old and we moved to Ireland. Yeah.
And is that where your family are from?
My dad's from Ireland, yeah. My dad's from County Waterford in Southern Ireland, yeah.
And then you were there for summer primary school, is that right?
Yeah, I was there till I was like 9, 10 years old, yeah.
Was that quite rural? Was that quite a rural childhood?
Where I grew up, very, yeah. I mean, there was not a lot around us.
Making your own fun?
Oh, making my own fun. I had one friend, Robert, who lived next door. And Robert and I would just sort of beat each other with sticks. And not in a fetishy way, in a sort of, you know, tomboy way. And just run around throwing cowpats at each other. That was our fun. That was it. I mean, it was Ireland in the 70s. There was not a lot going on.
Mm.
I mean, church was part of your entertainment. That was it. It was, you know, Sunday, at least you had church. You could go to have a sit down somewhere different. But other than that, there was nothing to do. There wasn't a cinema. There was no swimming pool where we lived. There was no... It was rural Ireland. In the 70s.
And when your family went to church, did they go because that's what you did on a Sunday, or was it because they were quite religious?
Part and part, really. My dad, Catholic. My mum was Church of England. My mum's English, but not very religious. But, you know, Ireland in the 70s, everybody went to church. If you didn't go to church, everybody knew about it. So
yeah.
It wasn't really an option. My nana went to church every single day.
Wow.
Yeah, 7 days a week.
That's a commitment.
Yeah, it was quite a big commitment. But again, I think it was partly to do with that. That was the social setup. That was community. That was, you know, how you met people, how you talked to people. Yeah. So I was brought up Catholic when we were there. I did my first Holy Communion, all of that.
And would it be like you were putting on your Sunday best to go to church?
I'm trying to think. We didn't really have any posh clothes. I don't know. Maybe I would have put on my slightly better cord.
Were you encouraged to sort of put on a nice dress or anything like that?
Ah, I remember my first Holy Communion dress. I remember getting that. I remember my mum buying it for me, and I had a growth spurt between buying it and the actual day. And on the day of my Holy Communion, I looked decidedly slutty. It was a short skirt by the time it was quite revealing. occasionally, my mum would try and put me in a little dress or an outfit. And all I remember from that period of time is just the entire feeling of rejection of it. It's very much like when I watch my Jack Russell now and I put an anorak on him if it's raining and he just stands there like a brick and looks at me like, this isn't happening. And that's how I used to feel when my mum used to put me in dresses, like a total body rejection.
Mm.
I wanted to be a boy because I had no friends that were girls. I had no friends that were girls when I was a child.
Even at school?
Primary school, maybe a couple at primary school. But, you know, I hung out with my cousins who were boys and Robert next door and my brother. And that was it, really. I don't remember, like as a young age, having female friends. So I always remember thinking it would just be much easier if I was a boy. This would just all fit in better. And I had an imaginary friend as well because it was quite isolating.
Who was your imaginary friend?
My imaginary friend was called Boy.
Just Boy?
Just Boy.
Nice to keep it simple, I always think.
Keep it simple, yeah. Yeah.
Is he now a man?
Boy and I separated when I was about...
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear
that.
That's
all right. We've got to separate. So you've just got to let them go. If you love them, Susie, let them go. but, yeah, I'd sit and talk to Boy for most of the day. It was, you know, I look at what parents have to go through now entertaining their children, and I think... We had nothing. That was only the 70s, you know. Go further back, it must have been even more dull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you've got a stick and that's
you. I had a stick and a cow pat, quite happy. They make brilliant frisbees in the summer. Absolutely brilliant. they hold their own.
There you go. You live and learn. And then was it for secondary school that you went to... Because you moved to Glasgow, didn't you?
Yeah, we moved from Ireland to Epsom in Surrey. When I was about 9-10 years old, so we were there for a while, and then my parents split up and my stepfather got transferred to Glasgow, so I ended up in Glasgow. So I went to secondary school in Glasgow.
God, you really moved around.
Yeah,
Wales, Ireland, England,
yeah,
then up to Scotland
and up to Glasgow. Yeah.
And what was, so for people, we have loads of international listeners, to give people an idea of what Glasgow would have been like, what would that have been in the 80s, mid-80s?
80s, yeah.
What was it like when you first arrived there? Do you remember it feeling different, or do you remember your accent being,
oh God,
you being very aware?
I found it really traumatic because I was still in a primary school in Surrey, you know, sort of a small school or a middle, you know, a little school in Epsom. And then I moved straight up to Glasgow into a comprehensive secondary school, which is a big change because normally you're moving up with the whole class.
Yeah.
So you're all anxious together. But I moved to a different, you know, country, different city, different school with a different accent.
Yeah.
And it was really hard, really hard. Because I hadn't been given that opportunity to step up with other people. I was just thrown in.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I found it really, really tricky. And my accent made me stand out. And I got horribly bullied. So I'd gone from jigsaw making and plasticine to kids smoking in the toilets and threatening to kick the shit out of me. So it was quite a big leap.
Yeah.
It was quite a big leap. And I really struggled with it. I really struggled with it. And, you know, my mum used to say, well... You know, so if they fight you, so you've got to fight back. And she'd send me into school without my earrings in so they couldn't rip them out of my head.
Oh, God. That's horrible. That must have been so frightening.
It was just very isolating. It's just very out with any sort of comfort zone at a sort of tender age. And that would have been about 11 years old. And the stress of it, my hair fell out as a kid. About 12.
Did all of your hair fall out?
No, half of it.
But it was very, was it very obvious?
Not really, because I had long hair, which really didn't suit me. But, you know, there weren't many options in the 80s. my mum and I were able to sort of weave it so that it wasn't very obvious.
Right.
I mean, if the wind blew in a certain direction, you were screwed. But I was able to mostly cover it. Even talking about it now, I can sort of feel that visceral, that sort of stress response. Not wanting to be there. Yeah, of really not wanting to be there, of being very uncomfortable. And it took a little while for me to make friends. But when I did, I had a lovely group of friends. I am forever grateful for them and the comfort and the support that provided, you know. I was a slightly odd kid as well. I think most comics are.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I was slightly odd. I was part bald. I was at that point beginning to realise that sexuality-wise, I was different. So not one bit of me fitted into what was perceived as the norm within that sort of schooling environment.
The status quo.
Yeah. My nickname at school was the freak. That sort of tells you it
really?
All.
Really? Oh, that's horrible, Zoe. I mean, you can laugh about it now, but...
Is it? Yeah. Yeah, and it stays with you, things like that. Those feelings stay with you. And those feelings sort of trickled through when I started doing stand-up. So those feelings of being different or isolated or alone, they sort of trickle through. And it's how you just sort of eventually deal with them and use them to your advantage and use them as your strength.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long was it until you made that sort of group of mates? Were you there? Was that like in the first sort of couple of years that you found that sort of gang?
Yeah, it would have been in the first year. It would have been in the first year.
And were they girls?
Yeah, yeah.
And with already feeling like an outsider and already feeling like you didn't fit in, and then, you know, thoughts, your sort of sexuality sort of coming to the fore.
Yeah.
Was that like, I can't, like, I'm not even going to consider dealing with that?
I wasn't happy about it, I'll be honest. I really wasn't happy about it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this as well. And the thing is, you know, there was very little advice for kids in those days. I mean, this
is Section 28 was in place, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the AIDS epidemic was in full flight, as you know, as horrible as it was. You were having leaflets shoved through your door saying, don't die of ignorance, and huge amounts of homophobia in the press. And, you know, whilst I'm not a gay man, I wasn't a gay man, but it was still just really brutal homophobia from the press. And so there was no sort of sense of positivity that I could latch on to.
I feel like we were often aware of gay men, but was there even like a touch point, like a reference point for a gay woman for you? Like, were you even aware of someone that was living out?
I'm trying to think. I was constantly looking for it.
Yeah.
I was totally looking. I was always looking for it. I'm such a bad reader as well. This is genuinely true. On a trip to London once with my dad, we went down Edgware Road and... This is genuinely true because I'm such a bad reader. There's like a row of Lebanese restaurants.
I know where this is going.
And because my brain went, oh my God, there's like lesbian restaurants here. This is incredible.
Oh God, they eat them? Or is it for us?
But I was constantly looking for something, constantly, constantly, constantly.
Yeah.
And some sort of anchor point to sort of you know, hang on to. And because of how it was, and you know, the situation as it was at the time, a lot of very visible lesbians were, you know, quite powerful activists. And
yes,
there was part of me that didn't really feel like I sort of latched onto that bit either. I was like, I just want to kiss a girl. I don't want to strap myself to a fence outside Greenham Common.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to that movement. And it was brilliant. And it sort of paved the way for people to be much more able to be themselves in the
absolutely.
Future. It absolutely did. When you activate change, it has to be brutal sometimes.
Yes.
It has to be in your face and it has to be with that vim. But for my delicate soul, I wasn't quite ready for that. You know, I wasn't.
But I think that when those... the voices that you hear are maybe sort of the loudest ones or the ones that are fighting. You sort of go, I'm not ready for a fight. I just want to tell someone who I am and for them to say that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. Exactly that, you know. And, you know, I acknowledge now but that was the only way of making progress. Of bang it out loud.
Of course.
But yeah, if you're 12 years old with a comb over, you don't really feel like banging it out loud. You just want somebody to say, it'll be all right.
Were you embarrassed about your hair loss? Were you always worried that people were going to see it? Was that like because I remember how I felt at, you know, 12, 13, like, you feel kind of gross. You started going through puberty. Mm. You're like, everything's changing. I remember feeling like sweaty all the time. Your boobs hurt. Yeah. Like everything just feels weird and not right.
Yeah.
Having that added thing of hair loss on top of it.
Yeah.
That must have been so hard.
Well, yeah, it was. And I'm very glad that I grew up at a time when you know, there was less emphasis on presenting socially as a sort of norm. I mean, I think I'd find it harder now as a kid. But no, everything just pointed to the fact that I was different.
Mm.
And yeah, there was no sort of comfy place for me. I found it in listening to music. You spent hours in my room just listening to music and fantasizing about being somewhere else and being a you know, pop star or something.
What music?
I listened to a lot of prog rock.
Great, sure, yeah.
I think because a lot of those concept albums had a story and they were fantastical and they would take you somewhere else. So I was able to latch on to that. And people like Kate Bush, who clearly weren't of the norm. So they were signposts that actually, if I get older and I have a sense of independence and freedom, I can create something better for myself.
Yes.
I listened to a lot of, I mean, my wall was covered in Grace Jones because I was like, there's a woman who doesn't, you know, looking like a woman, feeling like a man. I was like, oh my God, who's this? Who's this? You know, and she's not gay, but she's very much in control of who she is and very empowering. So I escaped that way.
Do you remember the first time that you saw sort of a positive representation of someone like you?
I mean, you'd think I would remember that, wouldn't you? Okay, do you remember? You're too young to remember. There was an episode in Brookside.
Where they kissed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was... that was huge. That was huge.
Mm.
And I remember that because also the characters, you know, didn't fall into that stereotype that had been so heavily pushed previously within the media. So that helped. Yeah, that was absolutely huge.
And when you went off to university, you went to York, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I never went to uni, so I don't really know. But I know that nowadays there's like lots of societies for absolutely everything. At that point, were you like seeking out like a queer society?
Totally. Yeah. And there was a, I can't remember what it was called, whether it was the Lesbian and Gay Student Union group or something, but there was basically four of us.
Oh. But at least there were three others.
There was one bloke in a cravat. That's what I remember.
Was it Tom Allen?
It wasn't Tom Allen. There was a women's group that I joined. But again, they were very, very political. And I just wasn't, I was trying to find myself at that point. I remember they used to sit and have meetings about changing the word history to herstory and manhole to personhole. And I just felt even more isolated and depressed. I was like, I just want to be a human being who happens to be gay. That's all I want at this point. And when I feel strong enough within that skin, then I'll be able to, you know...
have an argument about personhole.
Have an argument about personholes. But right now, I just want to find a little gang to feel comfortable in.
And were you out by this point? Obviously, you must have been out at uni, but were you out to sort of family and friends back home?
No, I did that classic thing of I told my little group of friends at school before we went to university that I thought I was probably bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
Totally wasn't. Totally not bisexual. I'm totally gay. But it was just sort of like a, well, I'll go up to the waist and see how that feels before I immerse myself completely in the sea of homosexuality. And they were, again, so lovely and supportive. And, you know, they were great. And then at university, yes, I remember coming out as gay to my friends there. I had friends there. But again, no, I didn't. it wasn't... again, I just did not find that right group to feel part of.
Mm.
Yeah.
When did you find that group?
I'm trying to think. So I went from university back to Glasgow.
Is that when you worked in a jam factory?
No, that, I worked at the Jam Factory when I was in my teens.
That was a lovely little fact that I found out about you when I was doing my research.
I got a job in a restaurant in Glasgow. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself at that point. I was really, I remember leaving university and just feeling utter terror because I still hadn't found myself, and B, I hadn't found what I really wanted to do.
Yeah,
I knew I wanted to perform, but I wasn't sure how. In those days, you know, the only way you could meet other gay people was there was Lonely Hearts columns in newspapers. Yeah, that's how I met my first girlfriend.
In a newspaper? Yeah. What did you do? Write off? Is that how you did it?
I can't remember whether, because it wouldn't be mobile phones, would it? No. How did we do it? It can't have been carrier pigeon. We're not that old.
was it a landline scenario?
It might have been a landline scenario. It might have. I can't remember, Susie. I honestly can't remember. But we ended up meeting up and, you know, we went out for a bit. And then I met my first proper girlfriend when I was working in the restaurant. Yeah. Yeah. And it was probably at that point that I felt more comfortable, yeah. Because we went travelling, we went to Sydney, we went to Mardi Gras, we did all of those things, you know. Went to New York, we had fun, went to clubs, it was at that point, so 25, 26.
Yeah, and then you were like, oh, okay, I can celebrate this part of me now. This is actually a fun part. This is something that's fun and exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think up until that point, it really hadn't. I was 21 before I told my mum I was gay. Mm-hmm.
I was about the same age.
Yeah, her reaction was interesting. I think I know now what she meant, but at the time her words were, I'm going to say, a little clunky.
Okay, sure.
When I told my mum I was gay, her response was, it's a little bit like being told your child has cancer. And I sort of, in my mind, I can sort of almost grasp what she was trying to say, but it was, it didn't help with the feelings of isolation.
Yeah, not the response you dream of.
No.
At what point did you start thinking, like, at 25 when you were travelling, you were with your first girlfriend, were you still thinking then, right, I want to perform somehow, I want to do something?
Yeah.
But it still hadn't quite sort of dawned on you what that was.
No, we came back from travelling. We worked together a bit in Glasgow and then moved to London and I went to drama school.
Mm-hmm. Did you love it?
Bits of it I enjoyed. Bits of it really didn't enjoy. I think it was at drama school. I'm quite glad I went to drama school because it sort of made me realise that full-time acting really wasn't going to be for me because you're so at the mercy of other people's decisions.
Oh, it's so hard.
So it was there when, you know, at drama school, I inevitably played the comedic roles and quite enjoyed that and realised I could make people laugh. I've always known I have the ability to make people laugh. It was just there. I went, okay, if I'm going to do anything along these lines, if I am going to perform, if I'm going to stay in this sort of business, then this is the avenue I have to go down.
Could you make people laugh at school?
Yeah. I wasn't the class clown, but given an opportunity, I could. So that's the sort of juxtaposition between being the slightly bullied one, but still knowing that you could make people laugh.
Well, it's a great way of getting out of being picked on, isn't it? I remember that, using it as a defence device.
Yeah, it's a defence device. Yeah. Yeah, it's like that. Look at my power. There's one thing, I used to do judo as a kid, and the one thing I've kept from judo is you use your attacker's strength against them. Yeah. So if they're coming towards you, don't try and stop them. You just help them along their way. And it's a really good practice to use in life. So if somebody is having a go at you, be it bullying at work or being, you know, trying to undermine you, often their arrogance and their sort of perceived strength is such that actually if you let them really go for it, they will eventually trip themselves up.
Yeah, give them enough rope to hang themselves.
That works. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was when we left drama school and, you know, I think one girl in our year got an agent and the rest of us were like, oh, right, it's back to waitressing then, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I thought, it took me a while. I thought, I will try and pursue stand-up, but it took me ages and I took a really long, convoluted path to get there. In between, I did a reality TV show.
Yeah.
2001.
Survivor.
Did Survivor.
Yeah.
And I think I did that. I think I was always very nervous about having the ability myself to do something like write a set and perform it. I just didn't know how to do it. But I knew given an environment where I could perform, I could perform. So I think that's why I ended up doing something as ridiculous as a reality TV show. Because I thought, there'll be lights, camera, action. I better can come out of this looking all right.
Mm-hmm.
And it might help me focus my brain on getting onto a track where I, you know, carry on. I know that sounds ridiculous.
And so for listeners who are younger or people that live somewhere that's not the UK, Survivor was like one of the early, one of the first reality shows.
Yeah.
And you all were sent away to a desert island, basically.
In Borneo.
Right. And you had to just survive. But you were on it for quite a while, weren't you?
Yeah, I did quite well. It's the thing I've learned about myself. If I put my mind to it, I'll sort of dig in. Actually, I mean, it was quite involved. It really was quite involved. It was quite hard work, but it allowed me to sort of get used to cameras. I know this sounds ridiculous. There are much easier ways of doing this. You don't have to sling yourself off an island of Borneo. But in the back of my mind, I was just trying to work it out. And Nigel,
it makes sense to me.
Sort of. But I mean, there must be easier ways, Suze. There must be easier ways.
Well, you know how hard it is for us to get on telly.
Just imagine. Well, yeah.
I mean, maybe there's not. Like, maybe at that point, like, what would it be another way where you could have found yourself in front of a full crew?
I don't know.
It makes sense, I think.
So it was quite a sort of convoluted way of doing it, but that's how I did. And I realised doing that, I was like, okay, I've got the confidence to put myself through something like this. I've surely got the confidence to write 5 minutes of material and put myself on a stage in a room above a pub. But at that point, I did not want to associate what I hoped would be a stand-up career with being on a reality TV show. So I left it 2 years and just sort of bided my time and then thought, well, there's enough time has passed.
Mm-hmm.
People won't remember. I can give it a go. And I count myself very fortunate in that, you know, in that sort of period of time. There was sort of limited social media. So I was quite lucky with the timings of it. I could sort of wheedle my way through without being, you know, that person who did that thing.
Did you not want other comics to know about it? Was it a Did you like try and keep it under wraps that you'd done a reality show?
I don't think there was the stigma attached to it. There was so little reality TV at that point that it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
The timing was absolutely fine. It was just enough to sort of, to make me realise what I didn't want from life, what I did want from life, and to go for it. And there was and I managed to sort of navigate it.
You said, like when we first started the chat, and I was saying about how, like, when I saw you and you were so at home in who you are on stage. I mean, you might not have felt at home. That would have been when you were about 8 years in.
Yeah.
How long do you think it took you to be like, I'm going to wear what I want on... Not wear what I want, but, like, I'm not going to try and think about what a comedian should look like or what...
Yeah.
Like, how long was it before you were like, I'm on my two feet, I know who I am, this is the material that I want to do, and you're going to listen? Because for me, it was maybe, like, 8 or 9 years. Like, it took me a really long time to be like, oh, I'm genuinely confident now. It's not just an act.
The answer might shock you. I don't know whether it will. It's probably in the last 2 years.
Really? That does shock me. Because you have always seemed so... Like, I've seen your Edinburgh shows. I've seen you on tour. I've seen you in clubs. I've seen you host. I've seen you do all the things. And Michael McIntyre's Roadshow, which you were brilliant on Live at the Apollo. You've hosted Apollo. That really surprises me.
There's always been a stone in my shoe.
Really?
Always. Oh, and I think most people have some sort of...
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. I don't feel confident every day.
No, but there's always been quite a big stone in my shoe. I'm going to say a pebble.
Yeah. Are you sure it's not just because you live in Brighton?
It could just be because I live in Brighton. I need to just take the shoe off and give it a little dangle.
A little shake.
But I think it's the last, two years.
So, like, just before the pandemic.
Yeah, perfect timing.
Yeah.
And coming out of it, I genuinely feel that. I've always felt like people have always commented that I seem so confident on stage or that, you know, I feel very at home on stage.
And yes.
Occasionally I do. But I've always felt like I'm the weakest on a bill or that there's always a bit of my brain that goes, you're getting away with this. It's the imposter syndrome that we all suffer from. We all suffer from it, but it was quite loud in my head. It was quite loud.
I mean, I understand that because I feel like, you know, I've certainly felt like that a lot. But I don't know. I feel like I could go in any green room in the country or to anyone that's like a touring comedian that's got, you know, that could have a massive TV profile and say Zoe Lyons and they'd say, Oh, she's brilliant. Consummate professional, always smashes it.
Which is lovely to hear. But
it's different feeling it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you've spent a long time of your life on the back foot, but I don't mean that to sound like a negative at all, because it's like anything in life. I think the longer it takes you to realise something or to consolidate something or to create something or to believe in something, when you do finally get there, it's unbreakable.
Yes, I agree.
Because you've had to question, you've had to, you question yourself. And if you don't question yourself, you're, you know, we all
know those comedians.
We all know those comedians. We all know those people. Question yourself. Perhaps yeah. I ask too many questions of myself. But once you do get there, if you've really considered a lot of things, when you do finally feel comfortable in your skin, and I'm 50 now, it's worth the long journey to get there. I don't mean to sound like the Dalai Lama here, but that's genuinely how I feel. And it's not that I no longer care what people think. I just value myself more than some of the negative comments that people might think about myself. And it's taken me a long time to value myself.
I mean, that makes perfect sense to me.
If you're the kid that's always last to be chosen in a team, if you're the one that's slightly different, if you're the only woman on Mock the Weeks, you know.
Yes, you were the only woman for such a long time.
If you're the only one of this, if you're the only one of that, then it just gets fucking boring. But you learn to be very self-reliant, and when you finally do get to a position where you think, do you know what? Double V's up to the world. It's unstoppable.
Can we talk about your alopecia?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I read that article that was in, what paper was it in the weekend?
It was in the Sunday Mirror.
Mirror, yeah. Yes. Dad brought it up with him. Dad came around to see me. Lovely. He had the mirror under his arm.
Lovely.
And I was like, my mate's in that today. I read it and it's, do you think that, so for listeners that don't know, Zoe, over lockdown, you experienced a lot of stress, lots of different things going on in your life, and you lost the majority of your hair.
Yes, by the time... Yes, I'll have lost all of my hair, but just not all at the same time.
Right.
It'll have all have gone. Yeah. Yeah. But just not all at the same time.
I mean, it was really powerful, I thought, that article. Also, like the way that you've spoken about it on social media and the way that you've sort of highlighted it. And I remember you saying, like, you know, in the post where you talked about it for the first time, you said, if this just helps one person. And I can only imagine that it's, you know, it will have such a wide reach that you will never know.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that it's something that people struggle with a lot more than someone that hasn't experienced it realises. Do you think that, you know, losing your hair and being someone that's in the public eye has helped you find that sort of resilience that you're talking about now, where you go, two V's up to the world?
Yeah.
Was that like a force alongside everything else to go, do you know what? I've got no fucking choice but to own this.
Embrace
now.
This and own it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had the most miserable year of my life because of various things that were going on. And I watched all my hair fall out. And it was, for me, really distressing. And as you know, none of us had much work going on either.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can tether ourselves to various rocks in life, be that family, be it kids, be it career. When all of your rocks have been washed away and you're just in a sea of despair.
Yeah.
Bobbing about with your bald head. It's challenging. So you have to. The only way you can go is there's nothing outside to grab onto. So you've got to grab onto something inside.
Yes.
I felt really desperate and I felt really vulnerable and exposed and sad. And because like I say, it's taken me this long to feel comfortable on stage. So the thought of going on stage without a full barnet really shook me. And there was a period of time during that whole thing where I just thought, I don't think I can do that. I don't want to do this. Why do I need to put myself through this? I don't want to. I don't need to. I can curl up and disappear. I can just
stop.
I don't need to do any of this. And then I think I just made the conscious decision, no. If this is what's happening, I'm going to own it, grab it, run with it. This is a small portion of my life. This is a small bit of my life, and my life's been brilliant, and I'm not going to throw all of that away because of, you know, a baldy scalp. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I have a brilliant life, And I'm going to carry on having a brilliant life. But I found it very, very hard. I had to make that decision to go and get a wig. And I know this is something that a lot of people have to deal with on a daily basis, and for much, much harder reasons as well. Mm. You know, I am fit and healthy otherwise. I always say that. I'm so grateful for that. I'm not dealing with chemotherapy or any other disease that's causing my hair to fall out. It's purely stress related. It just shakes your identity and it shakes your confidence. And I remember going to get my wig and I thought it'd be like, I'll get the wig and I'll be absolutely fine. But then I'm not.
Fixed.
I'm driving home with it on the seat beside me like a sort of rescue dog. And I just cried and cried and cried. Yeah. And then the funny thing is, after getting the sodden wig, every job I got after that involved being outside in a strong wind for weeks. So not only did I have to confront it, I was like, right, well, I'm really going to have to confront it now. I'll have to go strap this thing on.
Chin strap. Helmet on the top.
Gaffer tape, sellotape, you know, staple it
Yoo-hoo, prick.
And, you know, I was living, my wife and I had separated at the time, and it was brutally depressing. It was, it was so depressing, but I just plough on, keep going. Mm. Acknowledge that it's hard. Give yourself a break and plough on. And then when I decided to post that picture online earlier this year, oh, such a relief.
Yeah, I bet.
I'm not hiding it. Mm. I mean, it's just, there you go. And it really struck me because it was the first time, even just being in front of my friend Mark as the photographer and Emma, who was the makeup artist, that was the first time I've sort of exposed myself in front of strangers, my bald head. Yeah. And I was like, okie dokie. And I thought, well, let's just own this.
Yeah.
Own it.
But presumably when they then saw you and was like, oh, okay, it's still Zoe, just Zoe hasn't got all of her hair.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah, okay, I am still Zoe.
Yeah, yeah,
People still
see
me as me. But, you know, that's not to diminish what it must feel like. I can't imagine how hard it is.
I think it was because it was combined with going through the most horrible 12 months of my life as well. If this happens to me again, and it probably will because it's an autoimmune disease, it could very well happen again in the future. The hope is that I'll be in a better mental place and it'll be just a thing. Unfortunately, when it happened to me, it was part of a bigger thing. All I could see it as is a physical manifestation of the mental state that I was going through. Mm. I was mentally falling apart and my hair was coming out. So it was like every day I was trying to feel better, but it's very difficult when you're holding handfuls of your own hair.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't change it now. I wouldn't not go through that year.
Because you've come out the other side.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want this to sound like fridge magnet bloody, you know.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. We do a fridge magnet every episode. So you are going to have to give us a quote for the fridge magnet.
But it allowed me to pop out of it feeling so much happier.
Yeah.
So grateful for everything I've got. I'm really finely tuned to what I'm so good at saying no now as well.
Yeah, it's like, so important.
Yeah. The friends that I have, I'm so proud of my friendships. I have a full and happy life. Mm. Just not a full head of hair. I can cope with that. It's all right. The advantage of having a wig is it's always box fresh.
Always looks nice.
Always looks nice. So, yeah.
And I think that we did that job where we went away to Amsterdam together.
Oh, God, yeah.
But we had sort of been in touch a bit and I hadn't known the whole story. But, you know, we touched base a couple of times and I had loads going on in my life and obviously you had lots going on in your life, like, you know, you've just discussed. But I remember texting our mutual friend, Jen Brister, afterwards and saying, Zoe's so good. Zoe is so well. Because, you know, I think that, even, you know, I'm sure that you feel even better now.
Yeah.
And that was a few months ago. That was before Christmas. But there was, I think, like a lightness to you that I almost wasn't expecting because I knew that you'd had such a tough year.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's an incredible thing to, you know, go through as, you know, when you go through something like that as a person and then you get through it and you're standing still. And you're laughing still and you're still here. It's kind of nothing better for the soul because you go, oh, I've made it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm just laughing because I'm remembering that job in Amsterdam. We had to jump off a ledge, and I was, I remember saying to you, into a foam pit. Into a foam,
yes, pit. I was on Wig Watch.
If I pop up and it's not there, will you tell me?
You said, if it twists around the side of my face, just come and pull it back. Yeah. I was like, mate, I got your back. No worries. I got your back and I got your wig. Not a problem.
Yeah, it's... Well, okay, well, let's relate this to stand-up. People always talk about finding your voice on stage, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
It's what, you know, have you found your voice yet?
Yeah.
You know, do you know who you are yet on stage? And that's such a typical thing to say to a stand-up, you know, or off stand-ups and, you know, between ourselves, it's finding our voice. And actually, that's life, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's totally. Finding your voice. So you always know when you're watching an authentic act on stage because you can feel the authenticity in it because you yes. know they've found their voice. You know that it comes from a place of truth because all comedy mm-hmm. comes from a place of truth. And you know when somebody has connected with that and it is their truth. Equally, you can see it when it's somebody who's, you know, just saying
putting
words.
It on.
Yeah. So, and that is exactly how life is. It's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we spend a very long time trying to find our voice in life. And at the age of 50, I think I've found mine.
But I think that's great because I think some people never find it.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. There are people that absolutely fail to recognise that classic fridge magnet. This is not a rehearsal.
Yeah.
That classic fridge magnet of life.
Yeah.
This is not a rehearsal.
I've loved this. I've done more than 40 of these, and this might be one of my absolute favourites, Zoe. I've enjoyed this so much. Thank you so much for talking.
Oh, thank you.
So openly and honestly.
I'm just wanging on about myself again, Susie.
But it's so important to talk about stuff. You know, the reason that I started this podcast is because I wish it existed when I was a teenager.
Yes.
Because it would have meant so much to just hear grown-up gays, grown-up queer people going, oh, I'm fine, and oh, I worried. Mm. And now I'm fine. And you're not going to feel like that forever.
Yes.
Which is so important. It's, you know, sort of what I try and do with stand-up as well as just being like, oh, being gay for me is such a positive thing. I love it about myself. I'd never thought that I would. We ask the same question at the end. I say we, it's just me that does the show. I ask the same question at the end of every podcast. And I'm thinking about that version of Zoe, little Zoe, when she was at the school in Glasgow, and you said that you couldn't find a comfy place, which I totally resonate with, finding a comfy place and being like, oh, I can breathe here.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. When you couldn't find that place, if you could reach out to her or maybe someone that's in a similar position, you know, they could be anywhere across the globe, but they've not found their comfy place yet. If you could give them just a little bit of advice, what would you say?
That if you seek it out, you will find it, and that there are people out there who you will resonate with really strongly, and there are people out there who feel and have gone through exactly the same thing as you have gone through, and those friendships and those conversations are so important. I carried a lot through my teenage years without talking about it, and the power of conversation and the power of sharing and the power of connecting is the thing that will carry you successfully through life.
What a perfect way to end our chat. Thank you, Zoe.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was the brilliant Zoe Lyons. Thank you, Zoe, for coming on the show. I mean, she's not going to listen to this, but I really appreciated Zoe coming on the show. And thank you for listening. You can always get in touch with me. The email is hello@susieruffle.com. I'm always here. Well, not exactly here. You know, I'm in this little tiny room that I told you that I podcast from. But I'm around and I'm always ready to receive your emails. So if you want to share something with me, please do. I'll be back next week with another fantastic episode, and you have a great week. Okay, bye.